Hello, Jacob Jarvis here to introduce another Bunker Gold. This week, in the wake of Sunak and Truss's latest TV clashes, we've chosen Harsh Reality, How TV Shaped Modern Britain from December 2021. In this edition, Justin Quirk spoke to Phil Harrison about his book, The Age of Static, How TV Explains Modern Britain. They discussed whether TV has made politics worse and if live interviews might be better off being ditched altogether. We hope you enjoy it. And if you want to support us in making more shows like this one, remember, you can support us on Patreon. Search Bunker Patreon Podcast, or there's a link in the show notes.
Hello, and welcome to The Bunker. I'm Justin Quirk. You can tell a lot about British society from the TV shows on our screens. Perhaps more than any other country, the UK still gets a sense of itself from the output of its national broadcasters. But this country has become more fractious and divided over the past two decades as populist politics has informed the national conversation. So what can we learn from the TV of the last 20 years? And how has what we've been watching not just reflected, but also shaped the world in which we now live? Joining me today to discuss this is Phil Harrison, TV journalist and author of the recently published The Age of Static, How TV Explains Modern Britain. Welcome to The Bunker, Phil.
Thanks, Justin. Thanks for having me.
With the book, what was your starting point here? Was there a particular penny-dropping moment which made you think, hang on, maybe all this light entertainment I've been writing about is actually a bit more serious than we thought?
I wrote a piece for the Quietus website back in about 2014 about The Apprentice. And I think that was the point at which I started thinking, you know, this programme chimes in so perfectly with the way we self-brand these days, with the sort of aspirations that so many people seem to have these days, but also the fact that it seemed to get less ludicrous as it went along, that show. It was almost sort of framed as a comedy almost, where we would laugh at these people initially, but it felt like it became vaguely aspirational after a while. And I felt like that was a really significant change, that we'd almost sort of internalized the values of that show. And then once you start seeing it with something like that, you start seeing it everywhere. Yeah. The business TV, the sort of poverty porn, the sort of spurious reflections and proclamations of national identity on television. You know, it becomes a sort of a thing that you see everywhere.
And of course, you've been a television writer through most of this period that we're discussing.
Yeah.
And were you aware at the time that many of these shows were revealing something quite profound about where we were going as a society? Or do you need that kind of 20 years of distance for those things to emerge?
I think you need a bit of hindsight. I mean, I coincidentally started being a TV journalist in the year 2000. So, you know, the 20 years sort of framing device is actually really natural. But, you know, I don't think I did at the time. I think the first season of Big Brother started in 2000. And I think everyone thought it was quite a sort of a frivolous entertainment at the time. And I, you know, in some ways it is. But I think it did sort of reach out and end up having real world consequences. If not that show itself, then other shows that sort of spawned from it.
In the book's introduction, you write that television isn't always taken as seriously as it should be. In fact, it's often unfairly dismissed as the most disposable, least permanent of art forms. But television, perhaps more than any other form, is political. Can you explain what you meant by that?
Yeah, I think TV is something that pretty much all of us engage with. So we all have it in our homes. It comes to us. We don't go to it. So, for example, if you choose to see a certain kind of film, if you choose to sort of listen to a certain kind of music, you actually sort of seek that out. Whereas TV is a sort of national sort of squabbling ground almost, because, you know, whether we like it or not, we all have a stake in, for example, the BBC. So, you know, even if you've got people who define themselves by their sort of hatred of the BBC on ideological grounds or whatever the grounds they are still very much sort of invested in it, even if it's as a means of defining themselves against it almost.
You write a lot in the book about the transformative effect that that introduction of reality TV around 2000 had on the cultural landscape. But something you bring up, which I'd actually forgotten about, was how markedly different those first couple of series of Big Brother were. You know, they were quite something sort of weirdly quiet and quite slow and contemplative about them. What do you think changed with the show as that went on?
I mean, I was genuinely startled. I watched or rewatched quite a lot of the first season of Big Brother in the course of researching this. And it's genuinely remarkable. There's so much dead air involved and so few sort of bells and whistles. And there's something quite quaint about it, actually. They are having sort of proper conversations and they're looking after their chickens and someone thinks they might try and grow vegetables in the garden. And it's actually something quite wholesome about it. I think when the Nick Bateman thing happened at the end of the first series, the format was revealed for what it really is and was, which was conflict-based and, you know, a means of sort of establishing binary rights and wrongs. And I think you also saw how certain character types could do very well out of it and certain other ones wouldn't.
And do you think that was something which came from the producers as it was a ratings-driven thing, or was it that the show started to attract a different kind of person and kind of developed its own language?
I think it's probably a bit of both, isn't it? I mean, I'm sure people were eventually chosen for that show on the basis of their likely sort of telegenic qualities in terms of, like, causing conflicts and stuff. By the end of Big Brother, they were really a type, weren't they? They were of a very specific demographic grouping, and they were there to sort of push each other's buttons in a way. Whereas at the start, you really sort of genuinely felt like an attempt had been made to find a cross section of the country almost.
One of the strengths of the book is that you don't just go for the obvious easy targets. And as much as you write about, you know, things like Jeremy Kyle, you also keep, I think, some critical distance on shows which often get a free pass from people like us. I mean, you write at length about Brass Eyes, PDK special. That I thought was really interesting because that's always been defended by progressives as a bold, genius bit of TV. I think you give it a markedly more balanced assessment. How do you think that show looks after 20 years?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a product of a slightly more flippant era, isn't it? I don't think you can deny the sort of the comedy genius of it, or indeed the sort of the way it's assembled is utterly incredible. It's a remarkable piece of TV. But I do feel like Chris Morris's sort of moral and comedy instincts sort of jostles for space at various points in it. And there is a sort of ruthlessness and a sort of brutality, particularly to the Peter Geddon one, which can be a bit troubling.
Was there anything which genuinely shocked you when you went back to say, you know, presumably you were watching hours of this stuff going back through the archives? The section I was really on Jeremy Kyle, I mean, that really stuck out to me as something which you struggle to believe we just accepted that as normal daytime entertainment.
Yeah, I mean, the end of Jeremy Kyle happened while I was writing it, actually. And when I started writing it, ITV had packaged on YouTube all these little sort of highlights reels, basically, of like nastiest arguments and worst fights and things like that. And when the suicide of the participant happened, they removed all those immediately from YouTube. And you sort of thought to yourself, see, they knew this was terrible, didn't they? Yeah. On some level, they were deliberately exploiting everyone's sort of very worst instincts. And, you know, to do so in such a conscious way is shocking, really. The other thing that really appalled me is a BBC reality show called Britain's Hardest Worker, in which 0 hours contract workers were basically pitted against each other in a sort of reality TV scenario. And there was something almost, you wouldn't have written that in a dystopian fantasy, but yet it happened. And it was genuinely shocking to watch. And, you know, that's, in a way, that's where the tropes of reality TV led us, I guess.
And do you think that was, I mean, obviously you say these shows are both a product of their time and they're a reflection of, you know, the culture they come out of. Was there just something in the ether at the time where there was an appetite for that kind of cruelty? Because again and again, you pick up in the book, you know, these shows, you know, there's like Benefit Street is probably another example. There was, you know, and even shows that weren't specifically aiming in that way, like, you know, the ones around Jamie's school dinners and things, where there's this very clear delineation into sort of like deserving poor people, undeserving poor people, you know, scroungers, hard workers. Why do you think there was that? Because these weren't weird little niche shows. I mean, these were huge ratings busting shows. Why do you think the appetite was there?
I've got a feeling that the way working class people are portrayed on TV has changed quite a lot since, for example, the 70s, which was a much more sort of economically equal era. But also, you know, unions were stronger. There was more social housing. Everyone was just a little bit more sort of connected across the classes, it seems to me. Whereas in the noughties, you had the emergence of what became known as the underclass. And they became people who it was somehow kind of okay to sneer at, or it had become normalised to sneer at them. And I think, you know, you had things like Little Britain. You had, as you say, Benefit Street. You had a show like Shameless, which kicked against that rather brilliantly, I thought, and sort of gave it a much more nuanced reading. But I don't know. I think it's just like the winners and losers of neoliberal capitalism, isn't it, really? The idea that you will find your way out of poverty if you're a good enough person, if you work hard enough, etc., etc. But it doesn't work like that.
Hi, I'm Katie Riley. On the Slow Newscast from Tortoise, Donald Trump became the first former U.S. president in history to face a criminal trial.
The defendant repeatedly made false statements on New York business records.
This is not a trial. This is not an act of criminality.
We cannot and will not normalize serious criminal conduct.
This is the story of his first week in court, told through the transcripts. Listen now to the Slow Newscast wherever you get your podcasts.
You mentioned Little Britain there before. I mean, we talk a lot about how culture generally has become much more aware in the last few years of issues around diversity and inclusion. How do you think British television has reflected that? Is it making the progress that it should be?
It's funny. I mean, if I have one slight regret about the book, it's that I just about missed the opportunity to write about I May Destroy You, which I think almost feels like an implicit answer to one of the questions that I sort of ask in that book, which is, would we ever have a sort of a black female working class version of Fleabag, for example? And I'm not saying it is that, but I'm saying that's a show that allows its main protagonist much more agency and much more sort of self-determination than anything else I can think of in recent memory. And sort of working class people always have a hard landing in TV, and therefore, you know, you don't get any nuance to their stories. There's very few shades of grey in terms of telling working class stories on television. Whereas I think Fleabag's nuance partly comes from the fact that she gets to make so many mistakes and gets to sort of have a second and third and fourth and fifth chance.
Sure.
And I think I May Destroy was a really useful and genuinely brilliant show as well, but just a really good step towards sort of setting that right a bit.
It feels like in the last couple of years we have crossed something of a line in terms of awareness around those issues. Was there much you were looking at when you were working on the book which suddenly seemed very dated? I mean, the obvious example you mentioned, Little Britain. I mean, that felt like it got reassessed within about 3 years of being broadcast. And a lot of it wouldn't go out nowadays, I don't think. But were there other sort of things that stuck out from that era as probably being consigned to the dustbin of history?
That's interesting. I don't suppose you'd even... something like Citizen Khan, for example, the sort of Muslims family sitcom. It was a perfectly well-meaning show, but I'm not sure that would get made now.
Right.
And I'm not sure it should be made now, really. Because it just feels really box-ticky to me. And I don't think shows like that really help move the debate along.
There's an excellent chapter on the travails of the BBC over the last 20 years, from Savile through Iraq, Nick Griffin on Question Time, climate change coverage, impartiality in news. It's not the most glowing account of the corporation, and I think more so because it's obviously written from a place of love rather than hostility. Just how bad has this last 15 to 20 years been for them, do you think?
It's hard to think it could have gone much worse, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
And you know, they're never solely the architect of their own misfortunes, the BBC. There are so many people who wish them ill. And it's a very sad thing about our society and our sort of political ecosystem as well. But they do make a rod for their own back repeatedly. And I think quite a lot of their mistakes actually come from their unwillingness to hold a position. I mean, the stuff about Naga Manchetti calling out Donald Trump's racism, where the BBC threw her under the bus, then picked her out from under the bus again, then threw her under again. It was almost like they didn't quite dare say what was obviously true, which was those were racist comments. Hmm. So they ended up making it much, much worse for themselves and sort of upsetting everyone.
And do you think that repeated pattern, is that a structural issue about the BBC, or is it to do with the people that are in particular positions of authority? Is it a feature or a bug?
I think it's probably a feature, but I think it's a feature of the sort of unique place that they occupy in our culture, in that they are constantly answerable to sort of vested interests on all sides. And I think in a weird sort of way, maybe the BBC needs to be surrounded by that permanent level of conflict. And maybe if it's not doing its job in a way, because, you know, it needs to be a place where we are all confronted by ideas that we aren't necessarily particularly comfortable with. And it might just be that that's its role.
Yeah. And what state do you think it's in currently, and where do you think its future is likely to go, particularly with regards to things like the licence fee and the charter?
It's a good question. I mean, I have to say Nadine Dorries as Culture Secretary scares the hell out of me, because there is something about her that makes me think she might almost be a sort of kamikaze culture minister. She obviously has so much of a problem with the whole concept of public service broadcasting that I suspect she might almost have been put in place to undermine the BBC. I think it's just a question of getting through these next few years for the BBC, actually, and sort of retaining whatever semblance of sort of impartiality it can. The problem seems to me to be that it's now under attack from all sides, and not entirely unjustifiably sometimes. Lots of the people who would have defended it, say, 30 years ago, now also have a problem with aspects of its coverage. And, you know, that's a very hard place to find yourself in.
And not just the BBC, but television more generally, as you write, over the last 20 years has struggled to deal with the sort of shifts in our social and political landscape around how we deal with post-truth culture, with deliberate misinformation around climate or elections or COVID. Is the medium more widely learning to navigate that landscape, do you think?
I think it probably is, actually. I mean, the consumers of media are getting better at navigating it as well. And I think it has to be a sort of a hand-in-hand thing where we all sort of try and cooperate and work out how to do this collectively. I mean, we are going to have to learn to live with sort of disinformation, aren't we? And I think part of the reason things like Brexit and Trump happened was people may not even have been aware that they were living with disinformation. And I think knowing about it is perhaps half the battle. But, you know, there'll be better qualified people than me to talk about how this covert stuff works. But I just think there are things that the BBC, for example, could do in terms of, I mean, for example, they could stop running live political interviews. I think that would be a brilliant thing to do. And run
this,
them.
This is one of your suggestions in the book. Yeah. Can you elaborate on this a bit? Because that struck me as, that would be a huge kind of paradigm shift in terms of the way we cover the news.
I think it'd be wildly controversial, but I think if you could fact check them first and then run them with an audit of the facts underneath, then it would be very controversial and it upset a lot of people short term, but it probably would help eventually. It probably would mean people were less willing to go on there and try and get away with untruths. And I think the BBC could probably do that in a way that another channel maybe couldn't. I think there's a general problem, and I would say Question Time has been particularly guilty of this, of searching for sort of sensation above sober presentation of the facts. When Mentorn took over Question Time, the production company, they promised adrenaline-packed Thursday nights. And I'm not sure that should be the main priority of a serious news show. I'm not sure that serves our purpose very well.
So. Yeah. After 5 years, I think I could certainly do with less adrenaline in our
exactly.
body.
Yeah, can we just take the adrenaline out of this a bit, please?
On a more positive note, when you weren't watching hideous reruns of Question Time with Nick Griffin or 18 hours of Big Brother live feeds with Bubble and David from 2002, what did you rediscover that you thought were real kind of lost treasures? What would you recommend the listeners go and dig out again?
I mean, the obvious one which struck me is like a way of exploring national identity in a way that is gentle and inclusive and just generally goddamn perfect is The Detectorists, which, yeah. I mean, I think time will be very kind to that show. I think, you know, it seemed like quite a slight sitcom at first about two sort of like quirky losers almost, but I think it's genuinely visionary and genuinely beautiful, that show. And there's something so sort of modest about it, but so sort of comfortable in his own skin almost. And I you know, it bears repeated viewing, that show. And I think it's a bit of a sort of all-time gem, actually.
At the other end of the spectrum, the one that I'd completely bypassed me and you wrote about brilliantly was Southcliff.
Oh, God. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, an incredible show. It's one of the bleakest things that's ever been broadcast in prime time, I would have thought, that show. The first episode of it, where the spree killing happens, is stunning. But it's just such a brilliant dissection of that sort of rural v urban sort of conflict that we have in British life at the moment that seems to underpin so many of our issues.
And just finally, with the festive season approaching, I presume you've got your Christmas Radio Times. You've been going through it with the highlighter, planning ahead. What are you most looking forward to over the festive TV period then?
This is terrible, but I really haven't, you know.
Bill, come on.
No, I never really watch telly at Christmas because it's like Mrs. Brown's Boys Christmas Special. Call the Midwife is incredibly bleak, as always, Christmas Day. It's amazing how bleak Christmas telly is, actually.
I think it was the EastEnders domestic violence episode, probably. That was where the tone changed, I think, and since then, never come back.
There was an episode of Emmerdale where, like, a plane crashed into the pub or something. I was like, why would you do that on Christmas Day? It's just crazy. It's like an arms race to see who can make their show bleakest. But, yeah, very strange.
Well, we'll all be settling down to watch the old VHS of Threads on December 25th around at Phil's
Place. Watch Southcliff on Christmas Day. That'll do it for you.
Phil Harrison, thank you very much for talking to me today.
Thanks so much for having me. Cheers, Justin.
Phil Harrison's book, The Age of Static, How TV Explains Modern Britain, is out now in all good bookshops, published by Melville House. And thank you for listening to The Bunker. If you enjoyed this episode, you can back us on the crowdfunding app, Patreon. Just search Patreon Bunker Podcast to find out more. We'll be back soon with another episode of The Bunker Daily. Thanks for listening and goodbye.
The Bunker is presented by Justin Quirk and produced by Andrew Harrison. The assistant producers were Yelena Sofronevich and Jacob Archbold. And audio production came from me, Robin Lieber. Our theme tune is by Kenny Dickinson, and The Bunker is a Podmasters production.